Welcome to the Badlands, that overlooked place where philosophical thought runs into the political concerns of the day. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. I'm Toby Napolitano, and with me today is a man who just seems to get sick way too often. Michael Hughes, how's it going?
Hey, Toby. Yeah, you're not wrong. It's going.
And you don't even have kids. That's the surprising thing.
I have cats.
You have cats, that's true.
Yeah, but I don't send them out into the world, so yeah. that can't be it. Honestly, I think it's my wife.
Blaming her. Sorry, Amy.
It's not her fault.
We're apologizing to Amy already. We're less than a minute in.
Yeah. She goes out into the world.
That's fair. That's fair. All right. Well, a couple weeks ago, we started talking about issues relating to AI and technological innovation. And one of the things that we mentioned and sort of one of the more salient concerns for a lot of people when you start talking about artificial intelligence is the potentially tremendous negative consequences it could have on our economy, and in particular, concerns about displacing huge numbers of workers because of the automation of a large portion of the economy. And, you know, we said we want to start talking about these things in the context of universal basic income. And obviously, this is one of the primary motivations for thinking that we need a universal basic income. In fact, it seems like people, it's not just progressives, people on sort of all over the political spectrum are increasingly thinking that this might be a necessity, some kind of basic income to guarantee people some kind of basic standard of living is going to be necessary because there just aren't going to be many jobs around.
Yeah, and I think it's telling that even people in the tech industry who probably are benefiting most from this technology and this transition in the economy is currently undergoing are actually the ones that are raising the alarm bells loudest, maybe.
Yeah, and maybe not because they're, like, you know, compassionate or something.
You know, definitely not.
Right, there is a concern that it's, like, long-term, without some kind of really substantial basic income or some kind of really substantial government intervention, you know, you could, if you're looking at really widespread employment, you could be talking about severe political instability or just, you know, just not having anyone around who can afford to buy the stuff that they're making with their cool robots. It's the more cynical, probably more realistic take.
What's funny about it is we probably could just title this episode "Elon Musk is a Neo-Marxist," right? Because ultimately, what these people are doing are responding to the predictions and concerns that Marx made about capitalist economies and the ways in which they're self-undermining, right? And the primary thing he was concerned with, or one of the main things he was concerned with, is the way in which capitalist economies tend to amplify inequality and produce more growing inequality, particularly as technology advances. And many of these tech leaders, I think, can reasonably be understood as anticipating the social backlash that is likely to come about as a result of these technologies increasing inequality and sort of destabilizing our various social institutions.
Yes. So, in order to save capitalism, you have to move away from a more raw and brutal capitalism. As like I said, you know, Marxists and socialists should just say, Marxism, we do capitalism better. Yeah.
We just lost all of the all of our Marxist listeners just tuned out.
You know, and also relevant here is the potential for really considerable automation not only makes universal basic income seem like a necessity, but it also makes it more possible potentially, because along with the automation could come really tremendous gains in productivity. So there could be more, like a huge amount of wealth generated as a result. And the thought is, in those conditions, it won't be crazy to think that we could actually afford a pretty robust universal basic income.
Right. I have at least recently read that's actually part of Marx's historical predictions, right? Is that capitalism would potentially reach a point of abundance where it would allow for a transition to a different kind of economic arrangement.
And interestingly, I think it's precisely, if I remember correctly, precisely in that context of talking about like a post-scarcity world where he makes the famous claim to each according to his need, from each according to his ability. And I know people like Milton Friedman take that out of context and take that to be his sort of general principle for distribution in all conditions, which is not the case.
So in many ways, this the predictions that people have are actually predicting that Marx might in the end have been right about the direction that capitalist economies were heading in. It's just that they have interpreted Marx as having set the timeline to be much earlier and therefore refuted, when in reality it might just be that there's another stage of technological transition required before you reach the point that Marx predicted, where in a post-scarcity society you could actually have a distribution that's each according to their need.
And that's going to make those people really grumpy, because people really, really enjoy pointing out that Marx was wrong. They love that. It's kind of amazing how much people get off on that. moving on. So one of the things that I think is really interesting about this concern about automation and the sort of an automation revolution is I think it kind of throws two core tenets of American ideology, or what I sort of think of as like the American religion, into direct conflict. And those two things are the value of technological progress. I mean, I might say that that's like the core tenet of the American religion, more than democracy, more than freedom, whatever you want to say. I think that is the thing that people like really, really buy into. So the value of technological progress, but then also the idea that your standard of living ought to be earned, right? That you have to earn a living. So the concern that technology will automate most jobs out of existence suggests that I think one of these core values kind of has to be sacrificed, or at least deprioritized, right? Either you promote technological progress and give up the idea that you have to work to be able to live a decent life, or, you know, we could retain the current conception of work and block technological innovation. If you keep both, then the outcome seems to be really bad, right? You could get, again, mass unemployment and a highly unstable political situation, which, who knows, you know, could just lead to the collapse of our basic societal institutions. And I'm not saying this is going to be the outcome. In fact, that's sort of the main question for this episode. We're going to start just at least talking about some of the research concerning how likely that is to happen. But at minimum, right, it seems like one of those two things has to give if you are going to avoid that outcome.
Yeah, so I think it's worth noting, too, that this tension exists even in present day, right? We live in the post-manufacturing economy in the U.S., and clearly there's been a tension between these two principles as various sectors of the economy have been displaced. And I think it's useful to think about this both in the context of the present automation that's displacing people and the potential future displacement that could be in a much larger scale.
Yeah, and I guess I think it's also telling, right? Historically, how have we responded to that? Well, either we haven't responded to it at all and we just said sorry to those people. But if anything, the value that's given up is the conception of work and earning a living, right? The general acceptance of a welfare system at all suggests that that's the route people are going, probably. I think for most people, it's complete anathema to suppose that a government, for instance, could be justified in stunting innovation or blocking the implementation of new technology, even if it's to the benefit of its citizens or most vulnerable citizens. That's something that I think is just, for most people, completely off the table.
And honestly, to be fair, I think there's good reasons for it to be off the table. As long as you live in a society where some people's lives are particularly bad in virtue of their deprivation, right? As long as that's the case, and as long as technology can make significant contributions to the well-being of people, I think it's a very hard thing to defend blocking innovation.
I don't know. You know, I got to defend the Luddites here a little bit more. I mean, I'm not so sure, right? I mean, in a lot of cases, sure. And maybe for the major technological innovations. But suppose there's some company that makes some sort of high-end consumer good that's largely a luxury or something like that only wealthy people can afford. And the company is considering automating, and let's say it's a manufacturing job, right? Automating those manufacturing jobs out of existence. It seems that the only people who are going to benefit there are the wealthy consumers and the wealthy owners. I mean, isn't that a case where a government, I might even say a government has an obligation if they're not going to provide a substantial welfare you know, a substantial floor to those people who are being displaced. I mean, that seems like there are grounds to block it in those kinds of cases.
Yeah, for sure. No, that's fair. I was thinking more in broader terms of just general technological improvements.
So you're right. Transformative technologies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So I was thinking
electricity,
in particular about like electricity or artificial intelligence or other things that have the potential to greatly improve our productive capacities. I was thinking insofar as you have people who suffer from extreme deprivation and these technologies could be transformative, it should be off the table that we as a society block those technologies unless we can find other ways to address their deprivation.
Yeah.
But it's certainly the case that there are going to be specific technologies that are interest only to those who are already extremely well off. And there are, of course, trajectories that the technology can go in that only benefit those people. I mean, that in large part was our concerns in the last episode about artificial intelligence and medicine, right? A primary concern we have is that the technologies are going to be developed primarily to benefit the well-off. And so insofar as we're concerned with that, I totally agree.
And isn't this frustrating, right? Because like we have to be so cynical about technology and technological innovation for these political, sociological, and economic reasons. And you want to join in with the tech enthusiast who's like, this shit is awesome. And it's going to do great things. And wouldn't it be great if we could be like, yeah, that is awesome. Increases in efficiency are great. And in a more sane political, moral world, they would be, right? If those benefits were distributed a bit more evenly, then we could be those enthusiasts. It just makes me sad. Sorry. This is, I think, why progressives might come off as Luddites, because you have to be concerned with those political and economic problems, which are so much more intractable than in practice, they've been more intractable. That's also what makes it even more frustrating is that we think that they're not, in principle, intractable problems.
Right. I mean, it seems like, especially in a world, if you actually reached the extreme, right, where your technology could create post-scarcity conditions, you would think that in such a world where there really aren't limitations on what you can do for people, that there wouldn't be difficulty arriving at consensus about how to distribute these resources in a socially beneficial way, right? Or maybe to put it in another way, the more abundance you have, the more you would think that we would be able to arrive at consensus to do socially beneficial things. And yet, if anything, we see the opposite effect.
Yep.
So I want to get back to your observation about the tensions between technological advancement and the need for people to earn a living. Because I think it's interesting that if that's the choice, I think we need to examine the basis for those two principles. And in particular, I think it's useful to examine the basis for the idea that people really need to earn a living, and that's sort of a basic requirement that any society should establish. Mm-hmm. How do people justify, or on what basis is this justifiable? Is this just dogma, right? You called it American religion, right? Is it because these are the dogmas of the religion, or are there actual justifications that can be given?
Can I take a middle path and say both? It is a dogma. There are justifications, but most people don't hold those justifications or consider them.
Yeah, right.
But go ahead.
What?
It's interesting for us to consider if there are actually good justifications for it, which it seems like there could be.
Right. And in some ways, I do think that even the sort of non-philosopher has some intuitive grounds to accept the dogma, right? I think there's like a common sense kind of view that's like something like those people who work harder and sacrifice more of their time and energy, to produce what society has, those people have a greater claim on the resources that a society produces, right? That there's some sort of common sense notion of fairness that they have in mind, which is the reason that they accept the dogma.
And a common sense notion of work, where work, most people assume, means making a social contribution, right? Actually
right.
producing good in the world, doing good things for other people, including yourself.
Right. So I think people have that kind, I mean, like, that seems like a starting place for a lot of people for the way that they think about the relationship between people working and earning a living, right?
Yeah.
Earning it in some sense, an entitlement on existence. And under the current conditions, I think there is some sort of intuitive plausibility to that way of thinking about these issues.
We should note, though, that, right, just to say that being hardworking is good or working is good doesn't get you all the way to, and if you're not, therefore you don't deserve a decent standard of living. I mean, that's a tougher argument to make. But yeah, go ahead.
Right, right. But I think one of the things that's worth observing here, one of the reasons that the extreme scenario, right, a post-scarcity society scenario is worth considering, is the way in which it sort of presents a challenge to this kind of common sense way of thinking, right? So basically the idea is people who sacrifice deserve rewards for the sacrifices that they've made, right? But no one actually values sacrifice for sacrifice's sake, right? It's not like people think the sacrificing is a good in itself and that we as a society need to establish rules that ensure that people sacrifice.
That's endorsing masochism, right? That's right, something like that.
Right. And so it's in virtue of what they're producing, the social benefits that they're producing as a result of their sacrifices, it's really about encouraging those social benefits that you can kind of make sense of this grounds for that principle that, right, that you should earn your living. And in a society where if you can automate most jobs and ultimately the sacrifices don't actually produce something that is socially beneficial, if it is just sacrifice for sacrifice's sake at that point, then it becomes harder to make sense of why it is the case that one ought to earn their living. Even the basic sort of common sense justification that I think most people have just kind of falls apart under these sorts of conditions that technological innovation could produce. Essentially, if you think that human inputs into the economy aren't going to increase the outputs from the economy, then there's no real grounds to want to force or incentivize human inputs, right? And so then there's no way to make sense of or grounding this principle that I think is one of the dogmas of the American religion, right? And so, like, the obvious question or challenge is, okay, suppose that our technology is pushing us into towards a kind of world of abundance. How is the American religion going to evolve in such a world?
I mean, for the people who have like Marxist, socialist, and generally anti-capitalist leanings, getting rid of that bit of dogma, I mean, that's sort of the dream, right? I mean, and the post-scarcity world is, you know, as we sort of hinted at, like the Marxist dream, right? Because one of the great criticisms of capitalism is that sort of the vast majority of the population, which is economically subjugated, basically, not only can they not afford the nice goods of life, but they have to spend the majority or a huge chunk of their lives doing really tedious, dangerous, soul-crushing work, right? And so if that work can be automated and those people can still live well, that is the dream. that is the utopia.
One funny thing, I can't remember who pointed this out. This is not my observation, but this is from some TED Talk I watched a while back. You can actually see how people think about these kind of post-scarcity societies, how our thinking about this evolves through science fiction, right? And through a lot of early science fiction, particularly that written in the 18th and 19th century, these kinds of post-scarcity thought experiments always involved kind of utopian societies, societies where people were relieved of the responsibility to and requirement to do all this soul-crushing work.
To toil endlessly.
Right. And that's kind of been flipped on its head now, where people think, well, if they don't have access to this soul-crushing work, then how are they going to earn their existence?
Yeah.
Right? How are people going to live in a post-scarcity society when they're not needed anymore?
I think WALL-E is probably a good example of that, right? You have people who are, they don't even walk. They're sort of just carried around by machines and just consume endlessly. And the obvious takeaway is that this is a terrible way to live. Now, I mean, that gets into, you know, really interesting questions about work and things like that. I do worry a little bit. I mean, there's at least a concern that, you know, is this sort of flip to a dystopian image of these things just a complete swallowing of the capitalist values, which might not necessarily be good? Maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, so this is something we plan to talk about in, I would say, considerable detail in the coming weeks. I'm not exactly sure what's next week. About sort of the philosophical questions surrounding work and perhaps psychological consequences and social importance of work.
Before we move on, I think it's worth flagging that there's another kind of justification for this principle that people ought to earn their work.
you might have to in the future.
That's right. So what I was thinking is that the philosopher John Rawls has a justification for some of the standard social ills that seem to come with capitalist societies, namely the hierarchical nature of capitalist societies and the inequality that exists in capitalist societies, where he observes that those hierarchies and those inequalities could be justified potentially if it's the case that they're actually to the benefit of the people who are the least well-off in society. And I think this is another way of getting at the justification why it is that we think people should earn a living, right? We think we as a society mutually benefit when people are required to work. And one of the ways that we incentivize greater productivity is by rewarding those who are more productive, right? And if we can create conditions that reward people for their productivity, then there will be more resources available to all of us, which would then allow everyone to benefit more than they would were we to live in a society where all inequality and all hierarchy was banished, right? And so that's kind of a fairly standard liberal defense, the capitalist economic arrangement. And the thing I think worth pointing out is that this kind of technological extreme that we're considering problematizes that just as much as it problematizes the sort of common sense justification, right? Like, if it's the case that human inputs don't actually increase output, then these inequalities aren't actually preconditions to incentivize more productive human input. But it's, of course, not the case that the current extreme inequality is a necessary condition for increased output, right?
And it's also not the case that the distribution of economic benefits right now matches productivity, right? We'd have to understand we'd have to think hard about what exactly is productivity, and it's not clear that it'll be in the economist's way. Okay, so as I said, in the coming weeks, we're gonna take a big deep dive into philosophical issues around work. But for today, we want to talk more about the kind of basic concern that might motivate having universal basic income, which is the concern of AI automating jobs out of existence. And so then the natural question to ask is that going to happen? How likely is that to happen? Is this just a science fiction, daydream, or is this actually a serious threat? And if so, is it coming soon? Is it coming later? All right, Michael, what's the answer?
I don't know. I think, is it going to happen? Well, if we don't blow ourselves up.
That's true. I mean, that could be a major barrier to this happening.
That's definitely, if we don't blow ourselves up, there's probably some timeline, there's some point in the future, right, where something like that happens, right? But it could be so far out into the future that it's not worth theorizing about at the present time. Maybe it is, actually, but...
Yeah, so there isn't consensus on this issue among experts. And I'm just going to borrow the framing here from a paper from Edvard Brun and Alban Duca, a paper called Artificial Intelligence, Jobs, and the Future of Work, Racing with the Machines, which is in the journal Basic Income Studies. And they lay out what are sort of three kinds of scenario for how this could play out, at least economically, without considering massive government intervention. And so they're talking in particular like 20 years from now, in 2038, will the economy be radically different than it is now? Will jobs be automated out of existence? There's a couple things we don't know here. We should start with this. We don't know how sophisticated the technology will become and how quickly, right? We're just not sure. It seems like it's developing rapidly, but who knows? There are still significant questions about the kinds of things that artificial intelligence can do. And then the other thing we don't know is we don't know how the economy, again, even keeping government intervention out of this, we don't know how the economy will adjust, right? Some people are worried, again, it'll change everything. Other people point to past technological innovations and say, the economy responded and things were different, but it wasn't like the end of work for anyone or anything like that. So the first scenario then is one where there isn't a great deal of automation. The technology doesn't proceed as quickly as it might. And one where, therefore, there's no major adjustment by the economy. And it's basically, in 20 years, the economy looks like it does now. Another kind of scenario is one where the technology does advance very rapidly. So it's a high automation case. But the economy does adjust. So there's a period of instability where workers are displaced, perhaps in some industries, but other industries pop up, new jobs pop up, and eventually the economy recovers. And then the last kind of scenario is the really bad scenario where there's high automation, but the economy doesn't adjust well, and then you have mass unemployment, and then there's this real question about what do we do about this? What will be the consequences for our political institutions? Maybe then, in that case, it'd be really strong motivation for a serious universal basic income proposal.
I mean, I think it's worth pausing here and to note, like, even in the way you've divided up these scenarios, they very much depend on holding fixed certain political factors. The idea that you could have high automation and low adjustment, that is, you can have high automation, but the economy basically doesn't create new jobs. Well, that would be a bad scenario only if the political institutions don't evolve and adapt accordingly, right? In some ways, that's the ideal scenario. And there's this question of, like, what determines whether or not there will be replacement? And part of it is, well, are there things humans can do that this technology can't do, right? But that might just reflect a limitation of the technology itself. If it's the case that the technology can do any of the things that humans can do, that represents the possibility potentially of a post-scarcity society. And really, is that the worst thing, right? Well, only under certain political conditions, namely yeah. that we still require the people earn their living.
Yeah. For what it's worth, the Pew Research conducted a survey among a bunch of tech experts. And there was basically a 50-50 split among them concerning, and they're talking about 2025 here, so this is very soon, whether they think that automation will eliminate more jobs than it will create. Now, that doesn't mean mass unemployment, but it sort of gets you a sense of the direction they think things are headed.
It doesn't mean mass unemployment, but it's a pretty good indicator that you're trending towards unemployment.
Right, right.
Right. The economy is actually creating unemployment.
So maybe we should talk about the kinds of jobs then that we think will or can get automated out of existence. I mean, so what is the scope of the artificial intelligence tasks that we're talking about here?
So it's interesting. As I was like trying to come up with a concise answer to this question,
yeah.
I realized like I was going through various AI technologies that exist. And in some ways, the answer is like all jobs right now,
uh-oh.
Right? Because so it depends on how you're asking the question, right? Because are you asking what can the AI do? Well, then there are a lot of jobs that AI presently can do. It's just that we still have a lot of people doing them. Right. So it's like client services, help people who work in sort of help desk capacities, paralegals, financial analysts. These are all kinds of things that we have a lot of people who are currently employed doing that kind of work, but the technology is in existence already to displace a lot of those people. We just haven't undergone the displacement yet.
Is it too expensive currently, or just the distribution hasn't happened yet?
I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure about what the economic factors are. It's probably a little of both that at present. The technology, you know, you don't have the diversity of people, of technologies in the market to drive down the costs to consumers.
So that's interesting, though. I mean, because I think most people, when they think of automation, they think of manufacturing jobs, which is true, right? Those have been automated out of existence, and they will continue to be so, most likely increasingly. But a lot of the things you talked about were like high level, either service work or like high level, even white collar work, cognitive work that people probably think of as being not immediately under threat by these technologies.
Right. And it might not be that they're immediately under threat, but they are certainly under threat in the near future. I mean, that I think is what makes the developments in AI different from prior technological changes. Is it really does actually threaten a lot of higher level work, right? So like, and companies are employing this technology right now to replace some workers. Or to get a sense of just how high level the technology is in terms of the jobs that it replaces. Like economics articles by Forbes, at least some of them are now actually written by AI, right? They just have robots that go through and do the data analysis and produce reports. Remember, I think it was Planet Money podcast episode, but it might have been Radiolab. I always confuse the two because I always listen to them about the same time. They had an episode about exactly this technology, and they played clips of the articles that the economics articles that were written by humans and the economics written by the AI. And honestly, there's no one would be able to tell the difference. Like they played them side by side. I had no idea. You know, nobody would. So the technology is at least at a point now where it can do a lot of very high level cognitive work. And so a lot of people's jobs are certainly at risk in the next few decades.
And we haven't even mentioned the consequences of self-driving cars and trucks, which will put truckers out of a job, and taxicab drivers, of which I think I read somewhere that that's the most popular job for men in the United States. That's
taxicab driver?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know if that's right. I seem to remember that. But that's very significant, obviously, if that's the case.
Certainly truck driving. Truck driving was, I recall at least a few years ago reading the statistics on this, where truck driving was one of the most common jobs in many states, if not most states, though that has been dwindling in recent years. But if you take like the most common jobs in the United States and you automate them, that is going to mean a significant percentage of the population are displaced. And so those are sort of like, it's very obvious that there are some near-term massive displacements on the way. And then I guess one thing to note about that is there have been people who've pushed back and said, okay, so suppose we are able to automate truck driving, right? So you have automated cars. There are still various tasks that shipping stuff requires through trucking that will still actually require human beings to be involved, right? So it may be that the driving is automated, but there may actually still need to be human beings that are along for the ride to perform various tasks like unloading, at least for the near future.
Okay, so there's a significant threat to job loss here, at least long term. We don't know how near term, but the scope of this is potentially massive. And we haven't even, you know, talked about all the potential applications, which are very numerous. The question then, and this is the one that I think gets where most of the argument lies, is will the displaced workers be able to find new work? And actually, I think that's actually putting it in a slightly different way than most people talk about it. The way that most people talk about it is, will there be a sort of comparable number of jobs created sort of as a consequence or in response to the jobs that are lost? And another way of putting it is, will AI be like the steam engine and electricity, which were massively transformative technologies, which did displace workers in certain industries. But again, this was sort of the middle kind of scenario where the economy recovered, new kinds of work popped up, and people got jobs doing that stuff.
Yeah, I think it's worth pausing on why the steam engine electricity analogies so important or salient here. Those technologies displaced the vast majority of work that human beings did up to that point, right? It was actually human physical labor did most of the work that electricity came to replace, and that meant most of the work people were doing went away, right? So that's why people think, well, we've gone through these revolutions before where the vast majority of work being done by people was actually displaced, but that didn't lead to a dystopia because people were able to find new things that they could do and the new demands were created that those technologies weren't able to replace.
Yeah, and in fact, though, they can make a stronger argument, which not only did people end up finding work, but overall, standard of living went up because productivity went up and, you know, it boosts real wages, lowers prices, et cetera, all the goods of being in a technologically advanced society. So that's one of the arguments. That's one of the main arguments that are given by people who think that this isn't a huge concern. They'll say it's basically a historical argument. Look, we've been through these kinds of things before. People have been making these kinds of catastrophic predictions throughout history. They've all been wrong. People have always managed to find work. So why should we think this case will be different? And in fact, right, because of the increased productivity, things might be even better than ever. So one of the papers we read for this episode was one from Andrew McAfee, who we mentioned in that previous episode, MIT economist, and Eric Brynjolfsson. The paper is Will Humans Go the Way of the Horse? And they consider this kind of historical argument, and they say, and one of the replies is, the same kind of debate happened around the labor of horses, right? So the horse was able to survive many technological innovations that could have threatened its place in the economy, and sort of tongue in cheek here. But, and so similarly, you know, people thought, well, horses are just always going to be useful. But then the internal combustion engine came around and horses no longer were necessary, right? They were completely replaced by this kind of technology. And also, I guess, what do you think about this argument just as a historical argument? Because I think it's a really kind of shallow argument. That's right. We have like a couple of cases, and you have to be really careful when you make historical arguments because so much depends on the details of the situation. And we say, well, there's been a couple of cases where there's this transformative technology. It worked out then, so it'll work out now.
Yeah, I mean, that's, in general, induction's a dangerous activity.
It's true. And I never do it. I'm just kidding. It's impossible.
I do it all the time, and I'm harmed all the time. No, but it's, in general, induction's a dangerous activity. This is one of those cases where it's an induction based on a handful of cases with very, as you noted, very specific conditions in place. And whenever you're doing these kind of inductions, you have to think about how similar the conditions are now to the historical conditions that you're trying to perform the induction from. And the fact is that things are quite different from when they were, when there were horses, politically speaking, economically speaking. So, yeah, I don't ever understand why people think they can extrapolate some general conclusion from these kinds of historical inductions. So
I do want to interject
with you
and just say that
in terms of that,
horses are still around. I've seen them. They still exist. We didn't kill them all off.
We didn't?
So let me... Yeah, I don't know. They don't earn their living, so I don't know why we keep them around. But so many of those people who do make that historical argument, though, do appeal to a deeper principle. And that's what you want, right? Like, if you have this kind of historical induction like that, you want some deeper explanation as to why the mechanics of why things worked the way they did. And so they appeal to a deeper principle, which might explain this. And we can just call this the infinite labor argument, which is, so they say, for people who think that once these jobs are gone, that just means no new work will pop up, or just means that you'll have mass unemployment, is to make the mistake of what they call the lump of labor fallacy, which is the idea that there's a fixed amount of work to be done. But they say, right, there's no limit to the number of things that humans want. So if some needs or wants are taken care of, new ones will pop up and you'll need people to do those kinds of works. And so anytime you get rid of some amount of labor, it just frees up labor to do other stuff that there's some human demand for.
I'm not actually sure how convinced I am of the initial assumption. Like there's two ways of I think challenging this argument. One is this claim that human desires are boundless. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure that that is the case. So, but suppose we grant that for the time being, right? Let's suppose that it is the case that human beings can just dream up more things that they want. Then the obvious question becomes, okay, but why is it the case that human beings will actually be the solution to those new desires that they've dreamt up? Why is it that human beings are the ones who are going to have to produce those things? How do we know that it won't be the case that the technology that we produced will be the answer? Right. Now, I think part of the assumption is, so it's interesting because you can, in a way, the objection that you can make to this is to actually turn the argument on its head. So it says to think no is to make the lump of labor fallacy, right? That there's some fixed amount of work to be done. Well, there's another lump of labor fallacy that I actually think would fit more directly with the terminology, which is that there is some fixed amount of work that can be done by the technology.
Right.
Right. And so there's this assumption that there is no infinite amount of work, you know, that can be done by the technology, that it has, in economist terms, there's an S curve and there's a drop off as you add more technology or inputs of the technology into the economy. At some point, there's going to be a drop off in the outputs that result from those inputs. But in the case of artificial intelligence, you know, some technologists have claimed that this is precisely a case where there actually isn't an S curve, right? Where there isn't a limit on how much inputs from the technology will be able to generate new outputs. So if that's right, then it's going to turn out that the technology does provide the answer to these new demands that we dream up, unless, of course, the demands that we dream up are somehow something that only human beings can do, right? And the right. question then is, well, what is it that human beings can do that the technology can't do? So I think this is where the historical disanalogy becomes clearest. So if you think about like what happened with the displacement of horses, so really you can go even a step prior to that. Horses came in and started to do physical labor that had been exclusively the domain of human beings. And then what did human beings end up doing? Well, they ended up finding ways to direct the horses and do other things. Then the horses were replaced by electricity and other technology. And again, what did human beings end up doing? Well, they ended up creating the technology and they ended up directing the technology. There were clear tasks that the technology couldn't do that the human beings could do, right? And a lot of this, at each level, one of the things that human beings could continue to do is to provide intentionality, intelligence, and do important kinds of cognitive work that was needed, both in the direction of the technology as well as the creation of the technology. The thing that makes AI potentially different and makes the analogy ahistorical is the fact that it has the potential to replace a lot of the cognitive work that human beings do. It's in some sense self-directing.
Okay, and actually, one thing we forgot to mention, which we absolutely have to address, is this kind of, there's a kind of folk way to defend against the concern of mass automation, which is like, well, someone's got to make the robots, right? Or someone has to manage the robots. And so like one of the claims that's sometimes made, and this isn't particularly sophisticated, but I've definitely heard people say it, they don't just think that there will be new kinds of work that open up, but they think in particular, because there will be many of these artificial intelligences, they need to be managed and created. Now, one of the obvious objections that you point out is that can also be done by AI and likely will. The other thing which I can't help but point out is, right, even if that were true, even if we suppose AI maybe doesn't immediately take over that role, so people have to, you know, sort of manage the machines and also be involved in the production of them, which also seems very unlikely. the thing that that overlooks is the people who do those jobs are very different from the people who lose the jobs to the machines, right? The people who are doing manufacturing jobs, let's say, are not the same people who are going to be, you know, machine repair people, for instance. And also the number of those people is going to be considerably less. Otherwise, the companies wouldn't, you know, from an economic standpoint, from a financial standpoint, they wouldn't make the investment in automating everything if they needed just as many technicians to manage those things. Right.
Right.
One other thing, so you kind of made me think of a terrifying thought when you said, okay, this the argument that says that, look, there's no limit to human desires, and so new ones will always pop up. And you said, well, I'm not sure that that's true. I agree with you, but then you made me think of a terrifying future where, plausibly, there are really sophisticated, even more sophisticated than there are now, marketing AIs which generate those desires in people. And so that will be a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah. I think there's actually I can't remember what the name of this. It's an Electronic Dreams. It's on Amazon, equivalent to or like analog to Black Mirror. Uh-huh. And there's an episode very much along those lines. It's a sort of dystopian future where the primary product ends up being consumers, right? The thing that the AIs end up sort of focusing on in terms of developing is actual consumers and consumer need. And that's actually the thing that is primarily missing for them. I mean, I don't know. What do you think of that, though? So is it really plausible that human desires are really that boundless?
That's too big a question to ask, to answer. I don't know. Who knows? I don't know. and honestly, it's not. I don't think it's right to talk about human desires, right? You have to talk about humans within a particular culture.
Yep.
Within the present Western culture, maybe. In some other cultures, definitely not. They would just chill.
I don't know. So even in Western culture, where you consume and you consume more and more as a general imperative. There's a limited number of humans. There's a limited amount of time.
All right, you're making just a mathematical argument here. Like, is the cardinality of of human desires?
I'm just thinking, like, your economy produces technology to satisfy people's basic appetites and entertain them through all that time. What are these additional desires that we're going to manufacture when the technology can meet all of those demands? That would require more and more human input. That's the part I just don't.
Oh yeah, no, it won't require human input. I mean, that's a separate. Yeah, no, I don't see how that's going to work. But that's separate from the question of whether we'll find more and more work for the technology to do.
I guess I can imagine, but that requires more and more technology, even right?
Space travel.
Who wants that shit?
We're gonna need it, man. It's our only out.
I don't even like traveling to work.
I'm with you. I don't want to. Well, but you know, it's cool if some people do it. Like from just a sports team perspective, like the human sports team, like go humans. Like that'd be cool. If we get that achievement.
Sure. If you want to telecast that shit, fine. I don't want to do it.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, and this is maybe getting ahead of us here, but like. You do really wonder, as consumption ramps up and ramps up, you wonder if like certain kinds of Buddhism will just gain a really strong foothold when people realize they're still dissatisfied and they're like, what the fuck? And then people will kind of rebel against that kind of lifestyle. And like there might be a movement. I mean, there kind of already is. There's sub pockets of this. But like you wonder if there'd be an increased movement towards some simplicity in a state of abundance.
Right. Right.
Okay, so the last argument that people give who say that AI isn't going to create mass unemployment is to say that, well, there are some tasks that humans are still just much better than AI at. And that's true, and like we've sort of covered this. That may be true for now. The question is, going forward into the future, how long will that continue to be the case? And there's no guarantee that humans will be better at a wide variety of tasks. But I mean, I guess we should ask this question, and this is one of the things that McAfee and Brynjolfsson discuss. you know, we really should consider that. Are there some kinds of work that humans will still monopolize over AI? And if so, what kinds of work will that be?
So I think, yeah, to try to answer this question, you have to pick a specific time horizon, because, you know, if you're imagining like super AI or generalized AI, then it's hard to find too many examples.
Right.
But you're right. In the near term, I think we have to acknowledge that the kinds of AI that are being created are highly specialized at the moment, right? So in general, like complex generalized learning, so jobs that require that kind of cognitive ability, we don't currently have AI that we need to really worry about, right? So you might have very specific kinds of high-level learning. So like you can have an artificial intelligence that can understand economics figures and then write articles about it. But what you can't do is have it then develop social theories on the basis of those economic observations or right. anything like that. So you're going to have those very highly complex generalized learning tasks and jobs like being a professor of economics or sociology or something. Those are safe from those kinds of technologies. Then there are other kinds of specialized cognitive abilities that artificial intelligence isn't good at the moment. Actually, I really don't know the literature that well, and say that well really at all, about where we're at in terms of the state of emotional intelligence, right? There are ways in which, so I was going to say that an obvious kind of cognitive task that artificial intelligence is not as good at is emotional intelligence and maybe moral sensitivity. On the other hand, there are, again, specialized sort of artificial intelligences that do seem to be competitive with humans in terms of performing at least some kinds of emotional intelligence tasks.
And some kinds of humans that are terrible at performing those tasks. Sorry, I
said
most of
us. Yeah.
But yeah.
That's actually always an observation worth bearing in mind whenever we're talking about this stuff, is we as human beings vastly overestimate our abilities in almost all domains. But I think we mentioned this in the last episode, that artificial intelligence that are being used for therapy, right, can actually identify people's emotional states, like whether or not they're likely to be suicidal and things like that, or suffering from PTSD, are actually better at even those kinds of cognitive tasks than human beings are. Right? So again, it's like highly specialized versions of most kinds of cognitive tasks AI can do right now at a fairly high level.
So maybe a good example of something that requires a lot of emotional intelligence that's more general would be something like being like an early education school teacher.
Right.
I mean, what a task that is. I don't know how anyone does that. But that's right. The kinds of situations are so broad and varied that seems like perhaps the kind of thing that humans will be better at for a while.
So yeah, so Jeremy Howard in a TED talk he gave recently basically observed that in most developed economies, so economies like the US and European economies, the vast majority of jobs, like 80% of jobs, are service sector jobs. And those kinds of jobs are exactly the kind of thing that artificial intelligence has been developed to be able to do really well, right? So like help desk work, the people who work in call centers and that you deal with anytime you're dealing with a company, that kind of work, artificial intelligence can actually perform at a particularly high level, right? It's a lot of that work doesn't require the kind of generalized intelligence that we're talking about.
I guess one thing that's interesting, you know, I get this impression from the outside. I don't know if it's actually true, but you get the impression that a lot of this work has been explicitly been made more routine. Like,
yeah,
people in call centers, you know, have really specific scripts, for instance, that they have to stick to, even like IT help people. And it seems like the more that kind of work gets pushed in that direction, the much easier it is to actually just automate it out.
And even if you can't automate it out, the job becomes worse and worse, right? Because it becomes less cognitively interesting work.
Right.
Because you are basically, even when it's not automated out of existence entirely, the thing that's doing the primary cognitive research is actually the underlying machine learning and AI algorithms that are searching the massive database available to it to figure out what the best answer is to whatever question is that a person has. And then the job basically becomes relaying whatever information the artificial intelligence found. And once you get to that point, as soon as you have artificial intelligence that can do that direct interaction with people, the less need there is for the actual people, right?
Yeah.
So in the concern is that we are already at the point where, like, if you listen to Jeremy Howard, we're already at the point where at least 80% of the economy could be displaced by the artificial intelligences that are currently being developed.
When you put a number on it like that, it makes it really, really pressing. Yeah. Now, an interesting thing that McAfee and Brynjolfsson point out is there might be some work that is humans will always have an advantage at. I think you gestured at this before. Precisely because it is done by humans. I mean, so for instance, you know, if you think of services where the social component's really important, right? There are just a lot of things where you want another human being. So maybe in care work, for instance, maybe nursing, though maybe not, right? Depends on the particular kind of nursing tasks we're talking about. Childcare in general, right? You might want humans. You could also imagine that as time goes on, people will just come to prefer even manufactured goods, artisan goods that are produced by humans just because, right? Just because they want to consume human-made products as opposed to machine-made products.
That's
Etsy, for instance.
That is absolutely a thing today. There's a reason that Starbucks brands itself, right, as being this authentic thing that's, you know, the fair trade kind of marketing that you had from Starbucks a while ago was all about establishing the authenticity of the source, the things that you're consuming. Because people do, there is clearly a desire for sort of the authentic production by people. Like there is a preference for that.
And you can imagine that trend could become much stronger in a world where just about everything can be made by machines.
I mean, you could go back to the therapy example that I gave earlier. Artificial therapists might actually have more accurate emotional intelligence mechanisms than human beings, right? And can identify when people are in a state of PTSD. Nevertheless, I can easily imagine that people want to talk with somebody who is relatable, right? That genuinely understands their experiences and identifies with their experiences. And that kind of work, any kind of work like that where a human being would prefer to be understood in a deep sense in terms of lived experience and all of that, there I can imagine that it would be very hard to replace the demand for that kind of work with some sort of artificial product.
And in fact, right, that's the thought goes, it's a large reason why alternative medicine does well, because it's usually done by people who will take the time to talk to you, have a nice affect, as opposed to doctors who just will ask you a couple quick questions, say the case is settled, they're not really interested in listening to you. Even if those doctors are better at diagnosing and prescribing, people really want that kind of social experience. And even if you could have AI which kind of simulates that, you know, you can imagine people sort of still having the sense that it's not the same. Maybe not. It could go the other direction and it's like, sweet, these robots are great. They understand me like people don't. Who knows?
I think there's like two types of people in the world.
There's probably many more like, than two, but yeah.
No, there's two. There's two.
There's two people.
There's just two. There's people who are like, oh, I get to talk to a person? Awesome. And then there are people like, I have to talk to a person? Fuck.
I wonder which camp you fall in. Moving on. okay. So, but then an important point here is like, look, even if there are, like, at most, we're establishing that there are kinds of work that could survive for humans. The question, though, is a question of the magnitude. How many of those jobs will there be? And I mean, is it likely that the huge number of jobs that will be displaced by AI can all be kind of, you know, all of those workers who are displaced will move into kinds of works that are kind of essentially human or need to be human? That seems very unlikely. It seems very unlikely that the number of jobs and jobs where people can actually earn enough money to make a living, it seems like there just won't be enough of those in existence. It seems highly unlikely.
Agreed. It also seems like a hellscape for all of the, oh, fuck, I have to talk to people.
It's a hellscape for you. Right. So one question is like, or one problem is it doesn't seem likely that the number of jobs that are created in those kinds of fields is comparable. But then the other problem is, and this is often, very often overlooked by people who are more optimistic about automation, right? Because they'll say like, oh yeah, some industries will go out of business, but new ones will be created. Well, great. Well, what do we do with the people who were in the old industry that don't obviously have the skills to transfer into the new one? They're just stuck, right? And for them, there's going to be you're going to need some kind of serious government intervention in the form of some serious welfare policy or basic income to make sure that those people don't just live in poverty.
Yeah. And I think this, like, you can see this kind of playing out in the current state of things where you have all these, go back to the truck driver example, which is like the obvious field where you could see mass layoffs in the near future. And a lot of people who are optimists are like, yeah, but we're going to replace all of the demand for truck driving with a demand for software engineers and software developers and people to work and build on this technology. And it's like, okay, maybe it's true that the demand will be replaced, but is it the case that those people who were truck drivers are going to be well suited to transition into this new field, namely software engineers and software developers? And even if they were, like, even if it wasn't the case that there are selection biases in place that make it so that they probably wouldn't have gone into truck driving if they were going to be well-suited and happy as software engineers, it's still the case that there's going to be a considerable amount of time to retrain them, even if it is possible that they could transition at some point into these new fields. And there's a question of, what do we do with those people in the meantime, right? Do we just leave them to poverty?
Yeah, that is a concern, right? Yeah, and so like the response people make will say, oh, what we need is job retraining programs, which you sort of alluded to there. But and as I'm just summarizing what you just said, two big problems there. One, three big problems, really. Even if job retraining is successful for those people, probably their likelihood of getting hired over young people who are coming out of college with the same skills, probably they're at a disadvantage there, unless they have some sort of like mandated, you know, equal opportunity requirement that they hire some of these retrained people. So that's problem number one.
So just to, in response to problem number one, I do think the optimists have, they can point out that part of the reason that there's so, you know, that there, it's clear that there's this excessive demand for these new industries is that there are vastly fewer graduates than there are jobs that are available in that field. So they might not be the first that are hired, but there would actually be jobs for them.
Okay. Though you wonder for how long, because you can imagine that as far as hot majors go, anything having to do with computer science is just going to be off the charts. That's my guess.
Yeah.
But okay, so maybe there's a solution to problem one. Problem two, not everyone who's a truck driver is going to be easily retrained. Not everyone is going to have the same kind of inclinations or abilities and mathematics and similar related fields to be able to do that well enough to get a job, right? You'd be foolish to think that you can just sort of teach anyone to do that, especially at an adult age.
For two, I mean, that's, I think, the rejoinder to one, right? If it was the case that we could just train everybody or train enough people, then we probably would be, right?
Right. And then three, as you noted, and this is a big one, that takes time. Even if they were going to be successful, which, you know, who knows what the fraction of truck drivers who could successfully transition, that will take time and they will need some kind of income in the meantime. So it seems like even in the optimistic scenarios where there isn't massive unemployment, there are new jobs created to compensate for the old ones, you still will have massive unemployment of the populations that are displaced. And then there's so even if you don't get the doomsday scenario, it does seem like there's really significant justification for some kind of highly robust welfare proposal or even basic income, right, as an example of that. And one of the things we haven't mentioned yet is that, right, so while we did say that there's a wide range of jobs that can be displaced by automation, including jobs that are, you know, we might consider fairly good, you know, white collar, upper middle class jobs, the evidence suggests that the jobs that are most at risk are lower income, lower education intensive jobs. I forget the numbers, but they're vastly more likely to be automated out of existence soon and soon. So one of the consequences of all of this, it's not as though the whole range of income brackets will feel the burden of automation equally, but instead, per the usual, no surprise, the people on the bottom bear the biggest burden. They're the most at risk, as usual. And so there's a potential for even greater, you know, more incomprehensible levels of inequality that could result from this kind of mass automation.
And another reason to worry about the way in which this will magnify inequality is some think that the kind of jobs that are going to remain are going to be the kind of jobs that lead to a kind of superstar economics, which are fields where there is massive inequality even within the field itself, right? So some obvious examples of that are like authors and actors. There are various domains where there are lots of people who are employed in that field, but there are only a handful of people who enjoy the vast majority of the profits that are produced within that field. And there's a very sort of obvious or economic dimension that explains why this occurs. So Sherwin Rosen in his paper on superstar economics explains it this way. So there are various instances where one consumer's consumption of a service does not reduce that service's availability to other consumers, right? So like with books, an author writes a book, and that you buy the book, particularly in the digital age, doesn't then reduce the availability of that book to other people, right? It's just as available for everybody else. And so it becomes likely that the best stuff that's produced ends up being consumed by the vast majority of people, and everything else is kind of ignored, right? And it's why very few authors end up being the ones who make the vast majority of profits from writing books.
Yeah, and if I can really quickly, Brynjolfsson, McAfee, and Michael Spence in another paper kind of actually show how this can be amplified in certain cases because of network effects. So they talk about like Instagram or Facebook, for instance. Those didn't win out just because they were the best. They're the best in part because of the number of consumers who use it, right? So one of the sources of value of the product is the number of people who use it. And so once one of those, you know, Instagram has more users than its competitors, it's over, right? There just can't be other competitors because no one has the same kind of consumer base, which is part of the value of the product itself.
Right. And you can easily imagine that in the case where like the products that are being produced are things like artificial intelligences and softwares, various software packages, those things are exactly the kind of things that you can distribute in sort of a limitless way, right? And so it's obvious that they're going to be subject to these kinds of effects. And so on the one hand, we're going to be producing mostly jobs that or saving jobs that are going to benefit the wealthy. And the jobs that are going to be created to replace those other jobs are likely to be jobs that are subject to the superstar economics effect, right? So if you don't have political forces in place, if you don't adapt your institutions to respond to these factors, you can imagine a world with massive growing inequality.
Yeah, and one quick thing that's worth noting in the Brynjolfsson, McAfee, and Spence piece, they kind of pose superstar economics as actually a potential threat to capital owners and suggest that the distribution of resources will change in favor of the superstars who have the good ideas and away from people who own the capital. Now, that might sound nice because you're like, oh, well, owning capital, you know, that's... it can be something you inherit. It's not something you necessarily earn, blah, 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 blah. And having good ideas is great. But the number of people who have the extraordinary wealth in superstar economics is even smaller than the number of capital owners. The thought being, of course, that physical capital and the traditional capital is just going to be far less valuable because it's about the software, really. Not the physical stuff, but the coming up with the ideas. And
it might not even be the software itself, right? It might be that you have artificial intelligence that can create the software.
Right.
It's literally coming up with the product that the ideas about the products that the software might produce. And now in your super extreme version that you imagined earlier with the artificial marketers who create desires for us, there wouldn't even be a place for these superstars because the AI might even do their job.
Which, by the way, I don't take that to be far-fetched. I mean, I do take the job of present-day human marketers to be to create desires in people that they wouldn't otherwise have. And I imagine that part of that's already, there's probably a massive AI component to that already. I think that's probably one of the first things that will be automated in a terrifying way.
Yeah, if you go to Coursera right now and you look at courses on artificial intelligence and machine learning, probably the first thing you're going to come across is recommender systems, right? As being like the dominant domain in artificial intelligence and machine learning, right? So building systems to make recommendations to tell people what they want based on the data you have about their prior interests and desires.
Okay, so what's the conclusion we draw from all of this? Oh yeah, there is significant threat to at least a lot of people. And probably that justification given for considering universal basic income because of how innovations in AI will automate out of existence most jobs. Yeah, it seems fair.
At the very least, there are significant risks. They are very much in the near horizon. And if we don't start organizing politically, we may end up in the hellscape that everybody predicts.
Well, thanks for that. A nice uplifting conclusion, Michael. I'd expect nothing less.
As always.
Yeah. Wait a minute. You were hopeful the last time we talked about the medical AI.
I'm pretty sure I came around by the end.
That sounds right. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and thank you for the conversation, Michael.
Same here.
Get better, for God's sake.
Don't tell me what to do.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can help it grow by subscribing and by giving it a good rating or a review. And don't forget to check out our website, badlandsphilosophy.com, where you can find a list of citations for every episode and access written content that we post there regularly. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do that through our website, and you can also find us on Twitter at the Badlands Pod. Thanks again for listening.